This is Vermont Edition. I'm Patty Daniels. This week, we're doing something different on Vermont Edition. We're re-airing segments of the shows from 2015 that we loved the most. Each staffer on Vermont Edition gets to pick the topics for one show each day this week. And today is host Jane Lindholm's day, so I am turning the tables on her. Hello, Jane. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Patty. This is really weird.
It's great, though. So you have picked today's selections from three different shows to make up the hour. What are we going to hear first?
Well, almost a year ago, the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo was attacked, and as you'll remember, 12 people were killed in purported retaliation for the magazine publishing images of the Prophet Muhammad. In May of 2015, Charlie Hebdo won a Penn Courage Award in New York City. This was also around the same time that a security guard was shot when two people opened fire at a Draw Muhammad contest in Texas. Do you remember that, Patty?
Yeah, that was a really, really bizarre story.
Yeah, it was. And then those two suspects were killed. Well, we invited three Vermont cartoonists to come on the program to talk about satire, cartooning, and free speech. And I chose that interview because it seems like an issue that we are still thinking about and talking about: free speech, satire, the role of different people in sort of forming the conversation about American values.
Okay, so set us up. Where are we going with the conversation?
All right. Our guests were Alison Bechdel. She's well known for the graphic memoir Fun Home, which is, of course, now a Broadway musical. Harry Bliss, a frequent New Yorker contributor. And Tim Newcomb, an editorial and political cartoonist who often lampoons Vermont politicians. So the first voice we're going to hear here is Harry Bliss. He's reacting to an idea presented at the Penn Courage Award ceremony by the head of Charlie Hebdo. And he said that being shocked is part of a democratic debate, but being shot is not. So here's Harry Bliss.
I think in this country, there are a few examples of shocking satirists. Good example would be South Park. It's very much in the same vein as Charlie Hebdo. And unfortunately, those two creators, Trey Parker and Matt Stone's lives have been, I think there's a fatwa against them. Certainly, it's courageous, very courageous to put out satire that could get you killed. But being shot for satirizing any group is just wrong.
Tim Newcomb, I don't think anybody would ever say being shot is part of a democratic debate. But do you agree? Do you agree with Harry Bliss that being shocked is part of a democratic debate?
I mean, there was a great editorial by Brooks of the New York Times.
Oh, David Brooks?
David Brooks.
Yeah.
Which he said, you know, everybody's wandering around with these I Am Charlie T-shirts. But in fact, we are not all Charlie. That magazine just wouldn't survive in this country. If he pointed out that if it was printed at any university campus, it would be shut down very quickly for being hate speech. There was one when the French president Hollande was revealed he was having an affair. There was a cartoon printed in Charlie Hebdo of the president. I'm not sure how much I can describe this on air. Standing there with a zipper down and kind of hanging out there for everyone to see. And there's no way an editor, well, for most publications, I can't imagine the Times Argus or the New York Times printing something like that. It just wouldn't happen.
You know. 7 days might.
7 days might.
Well, Harry Bliss, where do you go with that then? Is it the cartoonist's role to say, whoa, I'm taking this a step too far? Or is it, in that case, an editor's role to say, are you kidding? We're not publishing this. I mean, should the cartoonist, him or herself, say, all right, this is provocation. It's beyond the norms of what society will take. Or should somebody else do that? You just do your cartoons and I get to say, no, Harry, sorry, we're not doing that.
Well, for me, I just draw the stuff up and I don't edit myself. That's something that Françoise Mouly, my editor at The New Yorker, art editor, cover editor, she will tell us, just do me a favor. Don't edit yourself. Just send in the ideas. And that's my job. But it depends on the cartoonist. I mean, I think in the case of Charlie Hebdo, some of those cartoons that were being so heavily criticized were actually very nuanced cartoons that were very specific to the French culture. And while at first glance they are shocking, if you dig a little deeper, there are some layers there where the cartoons are actually, in fact, doing something very different than what they appear to be doing. And so it requires a certain amount of research on the reader or the viewer of these cartoons. That said, cartoons are like, you know, they're so immediate and primitive. You know, they just they're not like prose. You know, they hit you on a visceral level. And I think what happens is it's like a punch, you know, and people on the other end of that punch, they don't, I don't think they're taking the time to really look deep. You know, if South Park has a show where they're depicting the Prophet Muhammad, the reaction is so quick and visceral. It's like this thing when I grew up, they said, you know, your mother wears army boots, you know. Don't talk about my mother. Well, the prophet has become, you know, replaced our mothers these days, so you can't do that.
And this apparently. Prescription against drawing the prophet is a very peculiar button for cartoonists that really pushes cartoonists' buttons, because that's what we do. We draw things.
Hmm. Alison Bechdel, you made a distinction between what Charlie Hebdo was doing and this Draw Muhammad contest. And certainly the Draw Muhammad contest drew a lot of criticism. It also drew two would-be attackers who were killed at the event. You see a distinction between what Charlie Hebdo was doing and what the Draw Muhammad contest was all about. So does the point matter? Is that where you're drawing the line?
Well, I would not have gone to an award ceremony for the American, what are they called? The American.
Yeah, I can't
remember
the fight.
Freedom Defense Initiative.
Yeah, that's right.
Pam Geller.
No, I would not have supported them receiving an award. What was the question again? don't get so very complicated. These things are really hard to think through.
Well, they are hard to think through. And you know, if you're looking here, so let me make it a little bit simplified from the two events that we're talking about and take it away from those two events. If you're looking at two cartoons which depict something that to at least a certain group of people is highly offensive, and in this case, in both cases, it was a depiction, a picture of the Prophet Muhammad. If you're looking at these two cartoons, two drawings, does it matter what the point is of the person who was creating them? Is that where we're making the distinction here between what's okay and what's not okay to put out there? You know what?
Yeah, I think it does matter. I think we need to be able to think about details like that. The world is not simple. People's intentions make a great deal of difference.
We got a note from Peggy who posted on our page to say there is a difference between incitement designed to provoke a violent reaction and satire designed to make people think. But Tim Newcomb, in the eye of the person who's reading that cartoon, that distinction may not always be clear.
So, No. And I mean, the reaction will vary from person to person. I mean, even depicting Muhammad, it's technically it is allowed in the Quran, although most Sunni interpretations don't allow it. I mean, they don't approve of it at all. Whereas in Iran, which is a Shiite country, they really don't have a problem with it. And
so for you, I mean, you are a cartoonist who often depicts political debates and politicians in Vermont specifically. You really take aim at what's happening in Montpelier frequently. How do you look at that and think about how people are going to receive it at the other end? And is that important to you, or are you saying, look, I'm drawing my point of view here, and then you interpret it how you want?
Well, I mean, being in Montpelier, I see all these people. So, it's you know, that does come into play. When I see Jim Douglas on the street on a regular basis, I mean, at first I would turn every shade of scarlet imaginable. And, you know, as I got to know him, I mean, he was a great guy. And, it did temper my cartoons to a little bit. I mean, I had a lot of fun drawing him, making fun of him. But he was absolutely gracious, figured, you know, if you're going to be in this job, you know, you've got to be prepared to you know, be lampooned. I mean, that's locally, but I mean, then you have regional interpretations or even international. I mean, if you're drawing a cartoon in France, there's going to be all kinds of subtleties about the illustration. It's not that other people are not going to get it, even in Europe. Even though we may all be Western, but there are colors in the, in the cartoon, not I mean actual colors, but I mean nuances that as Harry was saying, people will miss or misinterpret.
And there are actually colors as well.
Some of those colors, cartoons. Yeah.
But I mean those colors actually do have a significance in some of those Charlie Hebdo images.
Today we're talking with three local cartoonists about where satire, free speech, and hate speech converge and diverge, and we're hearing about how they draw the line in their own personal work. We're talking with Alison Bechdel, creator of the strip Dykes to Watch Out For and the graphic memoir Fun Home, among others. With Harry Bliss, a cartoonist and cover artist for The New Yorker, author of children's books and the single-panel comic Bliss. And with Tim Newcomb, an editorial cartoonist published weekly in 7 days and regularly picked up by national publications. And let's go to Betty, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Betty. Your thoughts.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is, I don't see any reason to attack any religion, no matter what it is.
Why not?
I think religions are everybody's individual use of how they see them, and I don't think it's necessary. There's plenty of things in this world to be satirical about or blatant, and there are certainly a lot of cartoonists out there that are blatant.
I hear what you're saying. Let's put this to our guests today because it's an interesting perspective and certainly one that was also swirling around after the Charlie Hebdo murders, this idea that should we be lampooning religion at all? Alison, where do you fall on that?
You know, a friend of mine, Judith Levine, who writes for 7 Days, made an interesting comment on this topic. She pointed out that Charlie Hebdo is their main thing is they're anti-religious. They're anti-all religions. They're poking fun at all religions. And Judith pointed out that here in the U.S. or in Iran, that would be a brave political stance. But in France, and this is something I didn't really register, in France, secularism is the law. That's the status quo. So in a way, Charlie Hebdo is just upholding it's not like a challenging thing that they're doing. They're just enforcing this anti-religious point of view.
Harry Bliss, do you have thoughts on this idea that religion should be off limits?
That's crazy. I mean, there's so much material there. come on. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was interrupting you.
I did a couple cartoons that dealt with religion. There was one that had two men outside of the Jewish Museum. And they were about to go in, and one man says to the other friend, he says, I was all set to go to the Guggenheim, but my mother guilt-tripped me into coming here. Now, that cartoon ran, and I received a bunch of letters from readers who were very upset, Jewish men and mainly men. And the tone in those letters was pretty angry, and I'm convinced it was because religion. Now, strangely enough, the next day, I got a letter from the Jewish Museum asking if they can use the cartoon as a postcard in the museum. And there was another one where I depicted the Mecca. And apparently someone, they were meeting at Mecca, but it was supposed to be Mecca Bar and Grill. But there was a pulled back view of Mecca, and there was a speech balloon. So the same thing, religion. Many letters from Muslims, that's a holy place. They don't drink alcohol, and I apologized to those people. But taking that off the table is just absurd to me, absolutely absurd. Nothing is sacred. Nothing is sacred.
We got a note from Mike who says, whatever medium you work in, communication has to get through to a critical mass of people. If you draw or write something that people don't get, it's not enough to defend it as your free expression. If it didn't get through, you have failed as an artist. I mean, certainly that's a perspective on the quality counting, you know, whether the quality matters. We got a note from Eileen who says, I'd like to know what they think of Joan Rivers' work. It seems now that she is gone, her former TV colleagues can no longer pull off her brand of satire. I won't ask the three of you to weigh in on who could replace Joan Rivers, but I think it's an interesting thought to jump off of that Joan Rivers, I mean, some people certainly thought Joan Rivers was a talentless hack. That's a perspective that was out there. But a lot of people thought she was very talented. And in as much as she was mean, she was also very funny. So, Tim Newcomb, do you think that talent is really the key here? I mean, if you're not funny, then it's not, if that's what you're aiming for, if you're just mean, it's not going to work. But if there's a talent to it, then somehow it's more okay, I guess?
Yeah. Well, I think with good satire, there has to be some kind of a message. not just blatant mud throwing. I mean, going back to religion, I mean, one of my favorite groups, Monty Python, back in the late 70s, around 1980, produced Life of Brian, which is personally one of my favorite movies of all time. But yeah, it was actually banned for something like 28 years. And even their main funder pulled out when they realized that there was so much fun being poked at Christianity and religions in general. And it was only because George Harrison of the Beatles came in and funded the movie. But at this point, and it was given an X rating. I mean, they really tried to discourage this. People got very upset. But in my mind, it's a brilliant movie.
I think you're right too. That satire does, you know, it can't. What Pam Geller did in that group in Texas was pure provocation. But good satire needs to move the dialogue. You know, obviously humor has something to do with it, a lot to do with it. But it needs to move the dialogue of what that humor is about in a forward direction. And
can we just talk about the brilliant Saturday Night Live?
Which one? The Taliban? What was it? The ISIS?
They had one this past weekend where part of it was not charades, Pictionary.
Pictionary game show.
Yes, and they had to draw things, and somebody got Muhammad, right? Allison, you've seen it. You can describe it, and nobody wanted to draw it.
But it was so brilliant because the two guys who went up to the drawing pad are standing there like terrified. Oh, my God, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And in effect, that sketch... they did not draw Muhammad, but they drew attention to the whole problem in a really wonderful way without actually drawing Muhammad.
I actually have, Allison, I didn't see that, but I don't know if you've seen this cartoon, you or Tim, but there's a, Glenn Lelivre is a terrific Australian cartoonist, and he contributes to The New Yorker, too. And I just recently bought the original artwork for a cartoon that he did that appeared in the Rejection Collection, and it's a do-it-yourself blasphemy, and it's the Prophet Muhammad, but it's connect the dots, which is along the same kind of similar idea. But you know what's interesting? I bought that cartoon from, I traded with him, and it came to my house. This is true. And I put tracing paper over the drawing, and I connected the dots in the privacy of my own home. and I just find that dynamic very, very strange. There's fear that's in the atmosphere about being able to draw or make art and put your art out there, and it's diametrically opposed to the amount of material that's out there on the internet. So it's a strange environment for satire, fear seems to be, really persistent
and powerful. That was cartoonist Harry Bliss. We also heard from Allison Bechdel and Tim Newcomb. Coming up, we'll go track bears in the Searsburg area, and we'll hear about the science behind what babies find funny. This is Vermont Edition.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Patty Daniels, and I'm here with Jane Lindholm talking about her choices for today's show. All this week, we are playing back some of our favorite segments of the year. So, Jane, tell us what we're going to hear next.
This is one of my favorite field experiences of the year. In March, I got to go out with the Fish and Wildlife Department to check on some hibernating bears that they've started monitoring as part of a multi-year study. By the end of last winter, they were safely ensconced in their dens, especially the females with cubs. So it was actually a pretty safe bet that we would find the bear where biologists had already tracked her earlier. So here we're going to pick up the trail as we're heading into the woods. Forrest Hammond, whose friends call him Frost, is the state's lead bear biologist, and he heads up a team monitoring bear activity in the Searsburg area. It's called the Deerfield Wind Black Bear Study. As a requirement of getting a permit to build a big wind farm, the Spanish company Iberdrola agreed to pay for a study looking at how bears are affected by ridgeline development. Radio callers on several bears in the area track their movements, and the information they reveal may help determine site requirements for future wind projects in Vermont and beyond.
And today, we're actually here to change or check the fit on a young female bear we actually caught in 2013. And last year we went to the den. She was a very young female, and we were very surprised that she actually had one little cub with her. She was one of the youngest females we knew of to have cubs in Vermont. And she's only 4 years old now, and we're very curious on whether or not her cub actually survived the year or not. And if it did, it's denned up with her in the den today.
There are seven of us on this mission today. Four Fish and Wildlife staffers, me, and a father and daughter who are along to observe. 13-year-old Kerrigan DeSorda wants to work for Fish and Wildlife when she grows up, so Hammond invited her and her dad along. We've parked at the top of a dirt road directly underneath the blades of the wind turbines that are already in place from a previous project. There's no wind, so they're not spinning very fast, but they're still huge and unsettling to stand below. Fish and Wildlife technician Jacqueline Comeau already scoped out the den where this bear and her cub are, so she's going to lead us to it.
This bear is actually the closest one denning to the existing wind farm that's down here. She's about half a kilometer away. The wind farm stops along the ridge, and the ridge kind of continues, and she's kind of down where the ridge continues and then off to one side. And she is denning in a beech stand, which is kind of the type of forest we're most interested in because of beech nuts, which are an important food source for bears. We're trying to figure out what impact having these turbines here might have on how bears decide to feed in those stands that are close to the wind farms.
The snow's still pretty deep up here on the top of the ridge, so we strap on snowshoes and step into the forest. We're making a lot of noise, but Comeau doesn't seem concerned. She's using radio telemetry and her GPS to try to find the bears. We walk along the ridge and then drop down a steep hillside. A couple hundred meters from where the bears are, we pause so the researchers can load up the syringes they'll use to tranquilize both the mother and her cub.
I think we'll load up and...
Right here?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is very noisy. They're going to hear us coming.
But this is what it was like the day we scouted. It was even noisier than this. And
she's still there.
She's still there, so...
The good thing is the deeper the snow, the deeper and better they sleep. And so they're not expecting any problems and stuff. And we may very well have to even dig to find the bears.
Comeau takes a couple of small vials out of a toolbox. She and Ryan Smith, a specialist on the team, load the drugs into large syringes. The drugs are a mix of sedatives, similar to what your vet might use if your dog has to go in for surgery. The filled syringes are then attached to long poles called jab sticks. There's a heavier dose for the mother and a lighter one for the yearling. Loaded up, we head closer to the den.
Ross!
We're probably about 50 meters from where they think the bear is now, so they've gotten everything ready. The syringes are on the ends of the jab sticks. Forrest Hammond is going to go up above where they think the bear is in case she runs up the hill. And everybody else is ready. Here we go.
The team runs over to a dead tree and stops. The GPS says the bear is here, right here. But where?
We know the den is here, but we don't know where the entrance is. And that's what we're going to have to dig to find out.
So Jeff is shoveling and Jackie is taking off her snowshoes. She's on her hands and knees. She's going to dig with a snowshoe.
The tree is about halfway up a very steep hillside. The wind turbines are visible through the trees, and you can hear the whirring of the blades, softly, but definitely audible. It takes some persistence, but they dig a little of the deep snow away from the base of the tree and peer in with a red flashlight. She's in there, and so is the cub.
I see her here. Yep. Ear tag yep. Right here.
He's, I think, on top of it. You want to try digging a little bit more, Jeff?
Just be ready with the jab stick over there, though.
She's hard to reach. The snow is deep, the entrance to the den is small, and it's very dark inside. It's hard to believe any bear could squeeze through the hole, and even harder to imagine two bears curled up inside the hollowed-out tree stump. Jackie Comeau and Ryan Smith are lying down at the entrance, trying to get in position. Smith holds the jab stick. He slides it into the den, trying to spot a good place on the mother bear for the shot.
Just don't see what.
Can you see that ear tag there?
I see the ear tag.
I don't know if you can just get a base of her neck. without hitting.
If she just turned her head, I could jab her.
Smith goes in for the shot.
Got some hair.
I don't know that she moved right when I jabbed.
Okay.
Get drug.
Yep.
I don't feel good about that jab. She turned her head.
They wait to see if the mother bear goes down. She doesn't. They get more drug ready. We wait 15 minutes. She's still not down. Smith must have hit her thick fur and not her muscle.
All right, let's drug her again.
Trying to get her attention, they talk to the bear, call her by the name they've given her, Medley.
Hey, Med.
They're lying down on the ground, holding the jab stick. They're both in an awkward position.
I don't know what's the cub and what's her. Is that her right there?
Finally, the bear turns. Kamo slides the jab stick through her fur and into muscle.
You got her. I don't know where you got her, but...
All right, you got another dose ready for the yearling?
Yep.
Then, as they try to prepare a jab for the cub, the mother tries to bolt.
Oh, here she comes. Oh.
Hey,
back in there.
Back in there.
Her head pops up through the hole in the tree. Kamo and Smith jump up, and they put their snowshoes on the bowl to keep her down. Then they place a coat over the opening, along with a snowshoe, and she stays down. 5 minutes later, she's asleep. But now they have to sedate the cub.
Oh, yeah, that's a little darker. He's standing up on his hind legs. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get him in the rib cage. Mm-hmm. Good, right there.
Get him? There's some jaw popping going on.
I think so.
This isn't quite textbook this time.
It's taken a couple of hours to get to this point, and now the team wants to move fast. They've got about 45 minutes or an hour before the bears will wake up. In that time, they need to check the weight of both bears and replace the collar on the mother. They also may need to build up a shelter of pine boughs in case they can't get the big sleeping bear back into the tree. They dig with the hatchet to get some of the ice around the den cut out. Then, very quickly, they pull out the cub. They lay him uphill from the den on top of a jacket. He's the size of a medium dog. His fur is a couple of inches thick, but very soft. His black toenails are sharp. His head is wide, with rounded ears on either side of his face, and his face narrows to a point at the tip of the nose.
He's a little fur ball.
He's just a total little poop ball.
He just isn't very large.
They slide a net underneath him and lift, hooking the net to the scale.
It's 37.
37 pounds. On the small side for a yearling, but Kamo says he appears perfectly healthy.
We believe this is her first offspring. She's still kind of learning how to, you know, get enough food to raise young, so first litters tend to be smaller. The first few months to year of life is the big hurdle, and then the next one will be next year as he's trying to set up his own home range and dealing with other large adult males. But it's a good sign that she was able to get him this far.
Kamo and Smith move on to the mother. She's been dragged just a few feet from the den. They hunker down to check her radio collar. The radio collars are supposed to last 3 years, but they can die in a year, so they replace them before the bear is out of hibernation. Medley's collar has been rubbing a bit, and there's an abrasion on her neck. The specialists say that poses no danger to the bear, but they do want to make the collar a little looser, particularly for the summer when she's putting on weight. They're actually concerned that this bear is as big as she is right now at the end of winter. It likely means she was being fed by a human before she went into hibernation. That's a problem because a bear that gets used to being fed by humans can become a nuisance bear, and nuisance bears scare people, so nuisance bears often get shot. Hammond says there's a neighbor down the mountain who's well known to the biologists.
He was feeding. We warned him. He posted his land, got a lawyer, told us we can't come on his land to see. But all our telemetry points are coming from his house now on her.
She's all when a lot of animals were going south into oak stands. She's one of the ones that never really left the study area, and we think it's because...
She was like the only bear that stuck around when there wasn't any food. And she's fat.
Fat is a relative term. Medley turns out to be 125 pounds when they get her hitched up to the scale. It takes four of them to lift her. That's a fairly standard weight for a female bear in Vermont. They usually weigh between 120 and 180 pounds. Male bears here are often about double that. But individual bears' weights fluctuate significantly based on the season, and that can make it really hard to fit a collar. In the summertime, when they're at their plumpest, their necks can be bigger than their heads, and the collars can slide right off, ruining the chances for scientists to study their movements. So they're careful to make Medley's collar loose, but not too loose. By this time, the cub has started to wake up. He's looking around and sticking out his tongue. They carefully nestle him back into the den. The mother's still out and too unwieldy to move, so they collect spruce boughs. They place them underneath her as a little bit of insulation, and then they make a tent above her so it's nice and dark and protected when she wakes up.
All right, let's clean up, guys, and get our stuff and get out of here as soon as we can.
The hope is that Medley will stay right where she is, but it's possible she'll get up and move around after she wakes. She won't go far, though, without her cub, and it's only a matter of weeks before she and the cub will be awake for good and off down the mountain in search of food. As we take a last look around to make sure we haven't left anything behind, Forrest Hammond underscores why studying these bears is important.
What we're trying to find is there a displacement distance from the turbines? Because the turbine's going to take out a portion of that habitat. And the question is, will the bears use all the habitat right up to where it's cleared? Or will it be a buffer distance of, say, 100 meters or a quarter mile or a half mile to where the bears use that less than what's available to them? And by following these bears' movements and behavior, we'll get an idea on whether or not there's a displacement from these turbines.
Iberdrola's wind turbines aren't built yet. The turbines that are here now, owned by Green Mountain Power, are much fewer and much smaller. Hammond hopes the bear study can get the funding to continue as the new turbines are built, so the team can get a true read on how bears are affected by a project this large. That won't help these bears if it turns out the wind project is detrimental.
That's true. What we're going to be learning is what the behavior changes are, movement changes, and we'll learn from that to know how to better site the future projects in the state. There's already projects that are proposed that we know will affect some bear habitat. Even the new proposed Stiles Brook project just to the north of here, just from the measurements on the Met Towers, we know there's some beach stands that would be involved with that and stuff as well. So maybe we'll have knowledge of this by the time that goes. It'll help the siting of that project.
It's late afternoon. Time to leave the bears in peace and trudge back up the mountain. Under the spruce canopy, Medley is still dozing. Inside the den in the hollowed-out tree, her cub is resting quietly, blinking in the dark, waiting for spring.
That was a story Jane Lindholm produced back in March of 2015. You should check out our social media feeds to see a pretty amazing picture of Jane up close and personal with a bear and a microphone in its face. Coming up, the science of laughing babies. This is Vermont Edition. And we're back. I'm Patty Daniels. I'm here with host Jane Lindholm, and we are sharing some of our favorite segments from Vermont Edition 2015. Jane, you have come to your third and final choice for today's Best of Show. What are you bringing to us?
Actually, I'm not going to tell you. I just don't want to give away too much about this choice because the first thing you're going to hear is so good. I just want everybody to listen. So let's just play the tape. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. And if that doesn't make you smile, you are a cold-hearted soul. No matter how many times I hear that baby, it still gives me the giggles. Humans are actually kind of hardwired to melt at the sound of a baby laughing. And it turns out we're hardwired to laugh, too. But until recently, not much was known about how humor develops in infants or what it says about babies' understanding of the world around them, of themselves, and of the inner lives of the adults that care for them. One Vermont researcher has been filling in the blanks, and her work is being recognized far and wide. Gina Miro is a professor of psychology at Johnson State College, and she joins us today to talk about how our sense of humor develops. Welcome, Professor Miro.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
So, do you still get a kick out of hearing a baby laugh, or do you have that, you know, sort of cold researcher's demeanor where this is purely research, not fun?
No, it still makes me melt as well. And in fact, when my undergrads are in my office, which doubles as a lab, and they're including the behavior of the babies that we study, we oftentimes have to pause the video and just say, aw. Or sometimes they'll beckon me closer and say, you have to see this baby. This baby is so cute. So we take a moment to do that, and then we put our objective hats back on.
You should do a study on what it does to the well-being, health and well-being of your students to be working on baby laughter all the time. I bet it does something.
I think so. And I do want to actually acknowledge, you know, I have some amazing undergraduates who work on this project who really are the cog in the wheel, so to speak, Cassandra Cousineau and Brady Rainville right now, who are just incredible researchers and have great minds and contribute so much, so as well as being lots of fun to work with.
When do babies actually start laughing?
Well, it varies a little bit, but generally speaking, around 3.5 or 4 months, and that is a universal developmental milestone. So it doesn't matter where the baby is growing up, where they live, what their language is. That's universal. It happens across cultures for typically developing babies.
And are they just laughing in response to some funny face their caregiver is making?
Well, it's a good question. You know, there have been a couple of studies that have looked at what makes a baby laugh. You know, what is there a universal joke for babies? People always ask me, how do I get a baby to laugh? And it turns out that there really is no universal joke. So it seems that some of the research has suggested that for young babies, 3.5 to about 5 months, that auditory and tactile stimuli are more important to eliciting laughter, but that for infants over the age of 6 months, then visual and social events are funnier. But really, when you look at any of those events, they're social. So ultimately, what it takes to make a baby laugh is another person, even more than a joke.
So at what point does a baby laugh even if the other person that's with them is not laughing or does not find it funny that the baby threw the food on the floor?
Right. Well, you know, this is something that we sort of accidentally discovered in our research. We really expected that young babies around 6 months of age would not find an event funny unless somebody was indicating to them that it was funny. Somebody else was laughing. So we set up these little experimental manipulations to essentially control the messages that parents were giving to infants during absurd events. And what just knocked our socks off is that these young babies found the events funny anyway, even when parents didn't give them those cues. So we subsequently dialed it back. We just completed a study with 5-month-olds and have found that 5-month-olds will do the same thing as 6-month-olds. They seem to, crack up at absurd events, even when mom or dad are not giving them those kinds of cues. We just didn't expect this. This is what I love about science, that, it's really exciting when what you expect is confirmed, but it's really, in some ways, more interesting when what you expect is not confirmed, because it sends you right back to the drawing board. So,
but 5 months, I mean, that's not
crazy.
Long after a baby has learned to laugh at anything.
No, it's really just about 4 to 6 weeks of laughing experience. So the reason that this is so intriguing to developmental psychologists is because humor and laughter really tell us something about what infants are paying attention to. So initially, our initial thought was, well, they're paying attention to the affect or the emotions of others. And it turns out that certainly the affect and emotions of others are important. But when it comes to perceiving or pulling out the absurdity, detecting that incongruity in the environment, they're doing it all on their own. The tricky piece now is to figure out, why is it that they're laughing instead of showing some other response? Why aren't they just looking surprised or interested, or, how is it that they know that this is amusing? So we're still sort of cracking the code on that, but we have some good guesses we're going to follow up with.
What are your guesses? Are you all ready to share any of them?
Sure, yeah. Well, one is that it's simply a response to the social. So again, these events that we present them with, they occur in a social setting. It's another person who's We say we're putting on little comedy clubs for babies. So there's another person performing this event, and mom or dad is present there as well. So that just provides a social context, and it could be that in and of itself is enough to cause the baby to laugh. And in fact, this might be their attempt to engage their social partners in laughing. Even with 4 weeks of laughing experience, they probably are pretty savvy to know that that's a powerful way to elicit somebody else's involvement or interaction. So that's one guess. The other guess is that, there's been all kinds of research looking at what infants know about the physical world. So starting at about 3.5 to 4 months of age, infants are really surprised by violations of physics. So, for example, if an object just disappears into thin air, or if you let go of an object and it doesn't drop to the ground, something that defies gravity, infants will stare at that with real puzzlement, as though this is not what they were expecting. But interestingly, they don't laugh at those events. So they recognize them, they pay attention to them, but they don't find them amusing. So one hypothesis that we're going to check out at this point, next in line, so to speak, is the idea that infants might have some expectations for social behavior as well, not just events involving physics. So so that's our second best guess.
And are you sure that when babies are laughing at that young age, they're laughing because they find something funny? I mean, you mentioned that often it may be to elicit a response from a caregiver, so maybe they just know that auditory signal gets their caregiver to smile back.
Yeah, this is a great question. And it is a little bit of a debate within developmental psychology about whether or not infants' facial expressions really give away their internal emotional experience. And there's two camps there. One camp says, well, we really can't know. And the other camp says, what are you kidding? I mean, of course they're expressing joy. So I think that there's, most reasonable psychologists would come down in the second camp and say, this is clearly joy. I mean, it's important to be skeptical scientists, but there's also physiological corroborating evidence that what we're seeing isn't just skin deep, that, what we see in their faces, in fact, is matched by a physiological response. And, not to get too far ahead, but we've just collected some really exciting data on 4-month-olds in our study, where we show them these same silly events, and they are not smiling more at them, but they are showing the physiological response we would expect. So it's as though they're distinguishing these events, the ordinary from the absurd events. It's showing up in their heart rate, even though it's not showing up on their faces.
Huh.
So this is super exciting. We just found this last week. And it's still, I have to say, to be a conservative scientist, we have to wait for the scrutiny of our scientific peers for some alternative explanations. But meanwhile, it's just really exciting.
But you do have evidence, too, that babies, as young as 6 months can fake laugh. And
yes,
you can determine that they are laughing in a fake way, not necessarily that sort of pure joy.
Yes. So my colleague Vasu Reddy found this in, she works in the UK, she found this in 8-month-old babies. And when I first started investigating humor in infants, I was looking for the precursors to what she found, so looking at younger babies. And she had found that parents would just anecdotally report that their infants would fake laugh. So we went about it a little more systematically to find out. And we found that parents in our first sample, when their infants reached 6 months, the vast majority of them had already observed fake laughter at that age. So it comes in a variety of forms. One is what would be called polite laughter. This is when the baby sort of wants to keep the game of peekaboo going, but maybe it's not that interesting anymore. So they kind of give a little, it's try a little harder, mom or dad. And fake laughter or the other kind of laughter is when an infant maybe is left out of a humorous interaction, maybe sibling and mom or sibling and dad are enjoying something, and the baby is left out, so they do a fake laugh. It might almost sound like a cough, but it's sort of like, hey,
I'm still here too.
Right, come on, I may be little, but I can share that joke. Yeah, so they see that. It's more of the infant's attempt to get attention. And infants fake cry as well at about that age. So.
Oh yeah, I think most parents will recognize that as well.
Right.
That flip side.
Yeah, I mean, laughter, one of the the qualities of laughter is that it's a really difficult emotion to fake. That's one of the reasons we see it as being so genuine in infants. It's pretty hard emotion even for adults to fake.
That was Johnson State College psychology professor and the head of the Infant Laughter Project, Gina Miro. She came on Vermont Edition to talk about the project back in March.
There's actually a lot more to that interview that we didn't put in here, including parents, listeners sharing what their babies find really funny. We'll put the full links up on today's show page so you can go back and listen to all of the stories you've heard this hour if you want, including our full-length interview about satire, cartooning, and free speech, and our story about bear tracking.
And that wraps up Jane's favorite segments of 2015. Tomorrow, we're going to hear from our producer, Rick Sangheri, on a whole host of things that he loved in 2015.
And Rick loves nearly everything, so he had a really hard time pinning down his topics. But he's going to bring us some great segments about the science of maple syrup, the life of Snowflake Bentley, and more.
All right. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangheri, Sam Gilrosen, and me, Patty Daniels. And we want to give a big shout out to Todd Mallory, Frank Elwine, and Mike Seguin. They are our top crack engineering staff that keep us on the air every day. We couldn't do it without them.
And I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.